This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We learned today the man at the center of the Ebola crisis here in the U.S., the man who came to the U.S. more than a week ago and began a frantic race against time and the ravages of Ebola, has died. Thomas Duncan, gone. The first Ebola casualty in the U.S. in this crisis, the first diagnosis of Ebola in the U.S. ever. As the president consults with federal, state, and local officials, we will get an update from Dallas and explore what are Liberian Americans saying about the events of the past several weeks. We're talking to communities very much sticking together in light of this crisis. Also this hour, whose side is Turkey on in the battle against ISIS? And a family's secrets taken to the grave, unraveled by a woman who still has questions from when she was a little girl. That conversation later on this hour. But we begin with the situation in Dallas. Joining us now is Eric Ossen, reporter at KERA in Dallas. Eric, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So the death of Thomas Duncan, in medical terms, perhaps doesn't change much, but it feels like it changes everything. What are you feeling?
A lot of subdued reactions so far this morning. Mr. Duncan passed away shortly before 8 a.m. Central Time here in Dallas. And a lot of email statements are coming out from officials who have been the public face of the local response here in Dallas to this Ebola patient, to the investigation. Lots of statements coming out from the local mayor, the local Dallas County judge, with condolences for Mr. Duncan and his family, but also with appreciation to Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital, the hospital where Mr. Duncan has been treated since September 28th, with notes of appreciation for hospital workers as well.
And all of those hospital workers now, the sense of reality of all of this is probably underscored by this fatality. The devastation of Ebola becomes all that much more real. Does it change any of the quarantine issues, the law enforcement issues, the school issues that have been kind of a day-to-day saga in Dallas?
Our understanding as of right now is that things continue to be fluid day to day with the monitoring of the nearly 50 contacts who had some sort of contact with him, either directly or indirectly. They remain, some of them, in quarantine under isolation, such as his close relatives, as well as healthcare workers who treated Mr. Duncan when he was transported to the hospital, and folks in the hospital who worked with him. But that includes daily temperature checks. That includes checkups with health officials. They have to obviously be staying put and not go too far so they can do those temperature checkups. But as of yesterday, none of those 50 contacts had shown any temperature. None of them had showed any signs or any symptoms of Ebola.
And the hospital has been very forthcoming in its sense of urgency and monitoring of the situation. Certainly it's had to explain its protocols in light of the details of when Thomas Duncan came to the hospital, when he notified them that he was from Liberia, and then when he came back. All of those things have been covered in the past. How much of a story do you think remains to be told about what happened actually inside the hospital?
I think that's the next step in this story. I think the hospital has sent out many statements, but they've been conflicting statements since last week. He went to the hospital. Mr. Duncan went to the hospital feeling ill, and then was sent home with antibiotics. And then a couple days later, went back, this time in an ambulance where he stayed until his death. Still a lot of questions as to what exactly was asked when he was in the hospital, when he visited the first time. Did the nurses and the doctors have access to the same types of records? There have been varying statements sent out. The hospital still, I think the media is still seeking clarification from the hospital on that. So I think the spotlight continues to be in the hospital at this time. But also keep in mind that Mr. Duncan had been in critical condition for the past several days. He was on kidney dialysis, receiving kidney dialysis, and also on a ventilator. So he had been critical but stable condition yesterday. So clearly things took a turn for the worse overnight.
Is there any sense, and this is going to come out really over the next week or so, is there any sense of the treatment of Thomas Duncan in the hospital in Dallas versus the aid workers who were treated at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta under the direct supervision of the CDC? And, of course, the CDC has been involved in Dallas as well. They received experimental drugs. We don't necessarily know what the nature of the treatment was for Thomas Duncan. We also presume that he was in much worse shape than those aid workers. Any comparison that you can make at this point, Eric Ossen?
You know, good questions. I mean, the big issue, as you mentioned, is the experimental drug that Dr. Brantley and Ms. Wright-Bull received in Atlanta. Those missionaries in Africa who were sent home, flown back to Atlanta for treatment at Emory, they received, you know, the drug, I believe, called ZMAP, and they received the last doses of that drug that were available. It takes quite a while to make those drugs. So that drug was not available for Mr. Duncan. However, over the weekend, Mr. Duncan received a different type of experimental drug that's kind of been fast-tracked because of the situation, called brincidofovir, which he started receiving over the weekend and continue to receive through the early part of this week. But we are not clear as to, you know, how that was administered, what other types of treatment he received. The hospital has only stated his condition, the fact that he was on a ventilator, and simply the fact that he had been receiving this experimental drug, brincidofovir.
Well, it's all very tragic in the fact that we are discussing the death of Thomas Duncan, but all of these details that you're recounting here are going to be very important pieces of data, bits of information, medical information that will inform the investigation and any treatment that needs to happen going forward for any of the people that he came in contact with. Eric Austin at KERA in Dallas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Of course, the death of Thomas Duncan in Dallas reverberates in West African communities all across America and the world with the communication networks such as they are today. Communities of Liberians, people from Sierra Leone and Nigeria, Guinea, and so many other so-called hotspots have been on alert since the Ebola crisis began. The risk and tragedies for families of expatriates are not unlike the story of Thomas Duncan, part of the family in America, part of his family back home in Liberia. Liberian Americans now see the possibility of the Ebola crisis coming to their doorstep, as it has in Dallas. Even though no one Thomas Duncan came in contact with while he was infected has reportedly shown signs of infection. We spoke to a Liberian American hours before we learned of the death of Thomas Duncan. Solomon Reeves came to the U.S. from Liberia in 1988. He now lives in Staten Island, New York, home to one of the largest Liberian populations outside of Africa, a tight-knit community these days here in the U.S., and back home in Liberia?
Well, it is a major concern in my community. In Liberia, most of the time, we come to each other rescue for the simple fact that in some areas, there are no means of getting a vehicle to take anybody to the hospital. And Liberia, being a victim of the 14 years of civil war, when I was there this year, April, we only have two ambulances. So anybody who see another person in need will come to that person rescue, whether to walk the person right to the hospital or to put the person in his personal car.
Are you worried about stigma, about people being afraid of anyone from Liberia saying, "Oh, whoa"?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It happens all the time.
Even really?
In a community, a friend of mine, he was there. He's a U.S. citizen. He was in Liberia visiting family and friends. So he came back sometimes in July, and most people were kind of afraid to go around him. And I went to him. I spoke to him. I hugged him, shook his hand, and I gave him a hand sanitizer. I said, "Hey, you're from Liberia." You know? So I was just kidding with him.
Do you have family that are in danger?
Yes. About a week and a half, almost 2 weeks ago, I have a cousin who is in the medical profession, and he was working in a region in Liberia called Lofa County and trying to help patients that were infected with Ebola. He himself got infected, and he died, and his body was burned.
And we've been talking to a doctor over the past 2 weeks who's in Bong County, where it's a terrible situation there. People are arriving at the clinic near death, and that, you know, he spends half his time simply sorting dead bodies and as well as treating people. Can you convey just how shocking the situation is there visually, the kinds of things that have changed for good?
When you are in Liberia, and if you have been to Liberia, you will see that at this time of the year, which is the heavy rainy season, moving from one point to another is even difficult in a city area where they have means of transportation, taxi and other private vehicles. But outside of Monrovia, when you get to go in the villages, like, you will definitely see that things are worse because people don't have means of getting to the hospital. And even we only have two major hospitals in the country besides clinics. So if there is a serious case in Bond County, they have to come all the way to Monrovia. And in most cases, they don't survive to get there. Yeah.
What would you want most Americans to know about this crisis from your perspective?
Well, I want for Americans to know that the situation is very, very devastating. So the more Americans or the international community get into what we call humanitarian services by having mobile clinics or training Liberians to be helpful to their own family members or their fellow Liberians, that would be good.
And you're speaking to Americans, but you are one of us. You are an American citizen.
Yes, I am.
All right. Solomon Reeves came to the U.S. from Liberia in 1988. He now lives in Staten Island right here in New York City. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
This hour, we've been hearing from you about family secrets, secrets that you might not tell, but you're telling us.
Hi, this is Kim. I'm calling from Maine. I never knew the reason my father came home so late every night from work when I was a child. I assumed it was because he loved his work so much, but when I was an adult, I found out that it was because he was cheating on my mom while they were still married.
Other secrets are all about history, going back generations.
My name is Dr. Walter Howard. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm the pastor of Destiny Church in Charlotte. I'm 61 years old. I didn't know until I was an adult that my father's mother was born a slave. It seems amazing to me that I'm only two generations away from American slavery.
Thank you, Dr. Howard. From New York, New York, my dad used to take a trip right before Christmas and come back with a beautiful Christmas tree. It wasn't until I was 18 and I answered the phone at home that I found out that my father had a brother in an institution in upstate New York.
Hi, this is Marie in California. Something I never knew about my family until I was an adult is on my 50th birthday, my mother took me out to lunch, told me my younger brother was not only my half-brother, but that my father had had an affair also. And my brother's father is my mom's foster dad. Pretty heavy duty to get this late in life, do you think?
I'm writing the screenplay right now, Marie. It sounds like August Osage County. From Kissimmee, Florida, my great-grandparents, who are still alive, married, and had five daughters, are actually first cousins. There's a revelation. Call us with yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. We love these stories. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. The U.S. is stepping up the fight against ISIS in Syria. Airstrikes have escalated against ISIS forces holding the town of Kobani under siege for weeks. Speaking today to ABC News, Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said the town of Kobani is facing a dire threat.
We think that most of the residents have actually fled, and so the town, whether there are still 5,000 people there or not is a matter of conjecture at this point. But I have no doubt that ISIL will conduct the same kind of horrific atrocities if they have the opportunity to do so.
General Martin Dempsey, clearly U.S. forces have no hesitation about confronting ISIS in this Syrian town sitting right on the Turkish border. But Turkey seems to be on the fence militarily, despite being a member of NATO and having long experience in military exercises with the U.S. But so far, it has not moved any boots across the border to confront ISIS in Syria. Does the lack of Turkey's troops increase the vulnerability of U.S. air assets like Black Hawk and Apache attack helicopters? We spoke with Jeffrey White, defense fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and a former senior Defense Intelligence Agency analyst.
The Apaches, while they provide a lot of very useful military capabilities, they're also more vulnerable to anti-aircraft weapons than the fast movers or fixed-wing attack aircraft we're using. The Iraqis have lost two attack helicopters in about a week in fighting with ISIS, either to anti-aircraft guns or to surface-to-air missiles. So it shows the risk. You can minimize the risk by taking different tactical measures and so on, but you can't eliminate the risk.
What's the tactical value of the Turkish military there on the border? Could they provide some of the capability that we're not willing to do with our own boots on the ground at this point?
They could, but they're not. Right? The, you know, they're sitting there. They haven't taken any direct role in the combat. The main role they've had so far is to prevent the Kurds from providing reinforcements, weapons, ammunition to the people inside Kobani. So they're not really taking any role except controlling the border. They could have a major role. The Turks now have quite a bit of armor, tanks deployed in the area. Those tanks are easily within range of ISIS positions and so on. But basically, the Turkish military is standing aside.
Military analyst Jeffrey White. So what is the deal with Turkey and its hesitations? Eric Schmidt, national security correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, says the administration is really struggling with Turkey's murky definition of what it means to be, as it claims it is, in President Obama's anti-ISIS coalition. Eric Schmidt, welcome.
Hi, how are you today?
So great. Based on your sources, is the U.S. going to watch as Turkey watches the town of Kobani fall to ISIS?
Well, John, it's interesting because the U.S. has actually stepped up airstrikes just in the last couple of days, I think in part because of the pressure, the international pressure, seeing these tens of thousands of refugees flowing from Kobani across into Turkey and the remaining citizens and Kurdish fighters trying to fend off the ISIS militants that are rapidly closing in on the town. There's increasing calls from international groups, including the UN, members of Congress, for both the United States and Turkey to do more. But these two NATO allies are a little bit at odds here on what to do next.
And what pledges has Turkey made that they're not delivering on in this particular instance?
Well, the Turkish parliament has agreed that it would contribute troops, including aircraft and basing rights for other allied aircraft, in the fight against ISIS in Iraq and in Syria. But in the case of Kobani, President Erdogan is appearing to hold out for more. What he wants is the United States to give more assurances that after it's done dealing with ISIS, it will take on President Assad of Syria. There's some concern among some of the Arab allies that have joined the fight that the U.S. is not totally committed to the overthrow of Assad, despite assurances from President Obama that they'll get to that. But the Turks want more ironclad assurances that the U.S. will support the rebels that are combating Assad and not allow the fight against ISIS to strengthen his hand.
I'll ask you a question about Assad in Syria in just a moment, but a lot of people on the ground who we've talked to in Kobani suggest that the Turks are conflicted about their troubled relationship with the Kurds and the fact that there is some evidence that the Turks are sympathetic with some of the Islamist groups inside Syria here, and that's also so-called complicated matters.
Well, it certainly is, John. Of course, the Turks have had a long confrontational relationship with some of these Kurdish groups that have supported separatism in parts of Syria, Turkey, and Iraq. And so there's not a whole lot of love lost between these two groups. For their part, the Kurds aren't necessarily, obviously they face perhaps completely being overrun in this city, but the idea of inviting in their longtime foes, the Turkish army, to come to their rescue is not the most appealing option for them either. So it is a very conflicted situation.
Is the demand or the assurance that the leadership of Turkey is seeking regarding a U.S. commitment to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, is that a legitimate strategic and serious strategic demand on the part of these countries, particularly Turkey? Or is it a position that they're taking knowing that the U.S. will never go after Bashar al-Assad, and so it becomes a face-saving way for them to not get involved here in Kobani?
Well, clearly, I think President Erdogan is trying to use this moment for leverage to force a very reluctant President Obama to commit himself more deeply to the fight against Assad beyond the support of the kind of train and equip program that he's already described. The president has training up to 5,000 rebel soldiers a year, probably beginning early next year is when the first group would be supported. Turkey wants more action sooner rather than waiting to defeat ISIS and then get around to Assad. Their feeling is let's go after both at the same time. The president is very reluctant to take on that at this point and wants Turkey to play a more active role in dealing with the immediate humanitarian crisis that it faces right across the border in this border town of Kobani.
Quickly, Eric, and I'm putting you on the spot here, any of these senior administration officials suggesting that Joe Biden, the vice president, is actually right about Turkey and some of the allies he's been critical of and had to apologize to?
Well, I think Vice President Biden, with as many gaffes that he's having to go around and apologize for this week, oftentimes is kind of speaking the truth, if you will, comments that many others in Washington wouldn't be able to say publicly. But there's a lot of frustration in senior levels of the U.S. government that the Turks aren't doing more, particularly since it's right there on their border and their best position to try and help relieve the siege of Kobani from the ISIS fighters.
Reporting on the frustration in the administration, Eric Schmidt, national security correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much, Eric.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Don't tell. No. Don't tell that secret you've been carrying around. But I'll bet you're dying to. I've always wondered, why is it that sometimes radio is a good way to get those secrets out? Family secrets. You can tell us.
This is Melissa, and I'm from Chicago, Illinois. I never knew that I had a brother and that my mother had a child before she was married, and that she was forced to give it up for adoption.
Thanks, Melissa. And I wonder if that the end of that story is that you're now very close with your secret sibling or still searching.
This is George from Salem. I never knew that my grandmother was still alive until I was in my 20s. My mother kept it a secret from me and my sisters. When she was a little girl, her parents went through a bitter divorce. Her one brother and sister went to live with her mom, and she and her brother went to live with her dad. She felt like she was abandoned by her mother, and she didn't want her mother to know her children later in life.
Wow, that's a big one. Thanks, George. And our friend Claire also has a pretty big story to get off her chest.
My name's Claire. I'm calling from New Jersey. Well, as the youngest of four children in my family, I didn't know until I was 24 that my father, who I adored and who adored me, was manic depressive and had abused my mother. My parents split up when I was five. And most of my childhood, I witnessed my mother being abused by an alcoholic boyfriend. Despite learning the truth about my father, I never loved him any less. The alcoholic boyfriend died 2 months after lung cancer killed my father, and I never felt more relieved. At age 52, I can honestly say he's the only person I ever truly hated.
Wow, Claire. I'm riveted. Thanks for all these stories, calling at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Here's one from Deer Park, New York. I always thought that my mother's mother was illiterate and could not read and write, but it turned out she was very literate in Hindi. She just couldn't read and write very well in English. Diane from Lyndhurst, New Jersey. One day when I was serving turnips, I found out my dad hates turnips because he and his brother were in an orphanage when they were young, and their mom was sick. My dad's oldest brother was a POW in Germany, and even his kids didn't know. Now, check this out.
My name's Elizabeth Watts from Nowata, Oklahoma. I grew up believing that my mother was killed in a car accident. And when I was about 8 months pregnant, I found out that she actually committed suicide. And inevitably, I was devastated. And after delivering my daughter, I couldn't climb out of the depression. And so began a long string of too many drinks at night after I stopped nursing her. I have since come to terms with it, but it was something that was not only devastating to me, but also I feel affected the way that I bonded with my daughter in the early stages of her life.
Questions about moments when they were kids barely understanding what was going on between mom and dad, their whispered conversations, emotional phone calls overheard through bedroom walls, moments, now memories, like this one.
I go to my room, my mom goes to her room and just shuts the door and spends the next like 5 hours on the phone. I don't even know what she's doing, but I keep knocking on the door and she's like, I'm on the phone. And I can tell she's crying. And I don't know why I thought, leapt to like the worst possible conclusion. But when finally she was off the phone and I went into her room and she's surrounded by all these Kleenex and I'm like, is dad dying? And she said, yes.
That's the voice of Whitney Joyner, whose secretly gay father died of AIDS in the early 90s. The consequences for Whitney's mother and for Whitney herself, now in her 30s, have defined their lives. the difficulties of moving on, freeing themselves from secrets and shame still alive in today's very different world from the AIDS crisis days of the 1990s. Joyner told her story to Anna Sale, host and managing editor of Death, Sex, and Money. Anna, welcome.
Thanks, John.
So this is a story that is very personal. It's about a family, but it's also about the echo of a crisis, really, from a generation ago.
Exactly. It's a generational story because it's about this population that's largely been invisible. Not only were people who were dying in the first wave of the AIDS crisis sort of invisible in that moment, but so were their children. And their children are just now trying to piece together what happened to their parents. And that's Whitney Joyner's story.
He seemed very healthy for a long, long time. Like, I never knew anything was wrong with him. The only thing I knew was wrong with him is that we would go to the hospital in Lexington and see this doctor, and he would get his blood drawn.
And you and your brother would hang out in the waiting room?
Yeah, we would just be in the waiting room because it was kind of like, oh, we're going to the mall and the movies and just stopping off at the doctor. And he explained that he had a blood problem. And at one point I said, oh, like leukemia. And he was like, yeah, something like that.
So there you've got the child as the little detective taking an innocent situation but seeing the clues. Mostly, though, this story is told in a kind of flashback, her looking back as an adult.
Exactly. Piecing together what she remembers as a child
right.
with what she later learned as an adult. For example, she's just learned from her mom fairly recently that her father lived with HIV for 5 years before he died in 1992. And it was a very difficult thing to know what to do when he found out he was HIV positive in 1987. This is how he told his wife.
I mean, this is like an example of why my dad was kind of, he was a wonderful parent, but not a good husband in any way. And not a good person in some ways. But he told her not to get tested. Because if she got tested and was positive, he wouldn't be able to live with himself, he told her. So
did your mom not get tested?
So she didn't get tested.
For him?
Yeah, she didn't get tested. I mean, she told me this just a couple of years ago. So finally she was like, I've got to get tested. And if I'm positive, then we're going to do this together. And if I'm negative, I'm getting a divorce.
So they make this deal, and she has to live this deal as a kid.
She has to live this deal. She knows her parents get divorced. She doesn't know why. But she does learn before her father dies that he is HIV positive.
She confronts him.
And yes, she learns that he's dying of AIDS. But she doesn't learn the whole story. And that haunts her. Here's what that conversation was.
And he said, so I've been sick. And I was like, yes. And he, I don't remember all the details, but he basically just said, I'm HIV positive. You know, he's emotional, his tears welling up. And I said, you know, I asked mom once if you were gay. Because I just thought, well, of course. Of course you're gay. And he said, I'm not gay. And I was oh, okay. But I was also like, but you're lying. Like,
when he told you he was HIV positive, did he say, and I have AIDS and I'm going to die, I'm not well?
No. He said, I really want to make it to see you graduate from high school. But he died 5 months later.
And what's so gripping about that detail is the whole time her dad is telling her that he's HIV positive, she already knows he's going to die.
She already knows he's going to die. She's learned that from her mother. But no one in the family learns that he's gay until after his funeral. They learn from mutual friends that he would go out and go to nightclubs, and that's likely how he contracted it. But they don't know for sure. So there's still this sort of mystery at the heart of what that part of her father's life was.
You know, there are secrets, but this is about half secrets, partial secrets. And you can hear her talking about how even for her mother, there was real reluctance to accept the full truth here.
And it's only now, over the past couple of years, that she'll be, like, telling me little by little. Because I think she doesn't want to remember. You know, it's so painful.
And at the height of the AIDS crisis.
Right. So that's when she was worried about if anybody finds out about this. I mean, she only recently has been like, Whitney, I was so terrified that if anybody found out that I would lose my job, your dad would lose his job, you guys would be kicked out of school, people would attack us somehow, that our house could be, we wouldn't be able to sell our house.
She discovers, first of all, her family is blown up, all right? She discovers that she's in the middle of this crisis that's in the news everywhere she looks. Does she carry resentment, scars? I mean, how does this fit in her heart today.
How she remembers it is a feeling of loneliness and fear, that real fear that someone would find out that her father was dying of AIDS. This was at a time when there was some public hysteria around it.
Sure.
And then also, you know, she was afraid of that in the community and from her friends and at school. But even within her family, when her father's dying of AIDS, there was a lot of resentment and bad feeling about how had he gotten AIDS. Remember, he was married to her mother, and that complicated things for Whitney.
You know, my family was very angry at him for lying about his sexuality. To me, it felt like our family was almost glad that he was gone. Anytime I brought him up, there's this kind of eye rolling on the part of my family. So I felt like I just shouldn't talk about him.
Mm-hmm.
And I would feel ashamed of loving him, you know, even though it's my father. And why would anybody have to feel ashamed of loving your father?
Does she still carry that today?
Well, it's interesting. Now she's finding other people whose parents died of AIDS. She's telling this story as part of a new project called The Recollectors. They're recollecting these details to not just kind of honor and remember their parents who died in sort of under the shadow of public shame, but also to sort of step forward and say, we exist. This happened to our family, and it wasn't a story that was told at the time. Now we're grown-ups, and we're trying to figure out how to piece together this story for ourselves. So she's put together this project called TheRecollectors.com that has all sorts of stories from the vantage point of the children of parents lost to AIDS.
Even though so much has changed about AIDS and around gay culture in the United States, there are still some steps that have to be taken by this generation.
Yeah, there's still secrets to sort of figure out how comfortable we are to uncover them. For Whitney, this is the story of her family. And as she's put together this project, she's gotten support from cousins. She's talking much more with her mother about her father. So it has uncovered for her what was sort of veiled over and a mystery for a number of years.
She's not ashamed to have loved her dad at this point.
Yeah, exactly.
Anna Sale, host and managing editor of Death, Sex, and Money. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can hear Whitney Joyner's full story by visiting deathsexmoney.org. And if you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at takeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.